Hello and welcome to Conversations on a Friday. Gitano Ban is a singer-songwriter. He's got Torres Strait Islander and Scottish heritage. And just like just about every Torres Strait Islander I've met, it seems, he's a consummate guitarist. I've seen Gitano perform and he's a seriously charismatic guy. And charismatic in the way that makes you suspect that he would have had a rich and complex life story. And so it is. Gitano is, as he puts it, the son of a dad who was a 10-pound Scot from Aberdeen, and a mum who was the granddaughter of one of the last cannibal chieftains of the Torres Strait. Gitano Ban sees music as his salvation, and now he works to bring that salvation to street kids and refugees, to unlock their feelings of grief, rage, and sometimes the odd bit of joy as well. Hi, Gitano.
Hi, Richard.
Now, I knew pretty much after a couple of minutes of talking to you that I'd have to bring you on this program. Were you realising you were auditioning for this program at the time? Did you realise it?
No, not at all.
Let's talk a bit about your heritage. Tell me about the background of your mum and your dad.
Well, my dad was a 10-pound Scotsman who came to Australia with a group of friends, and I think he was 13 years old, and his father told him to get out and get a life and get a job, and he was living in a barn with a couple of other young guys, and to sustain their existence in the barn, I think they were next to a golf course and they used to collect golf balls and sell them as food for themselves, and they'd huddle at night. So
your dad was making food by pinching golf balls and selling them on?
And my mother is a descendant of a cannibal war chief from the central regions of the Torres Straits. Her migration from the Torres Straits to Mackay is a story within itself. That's the polarised childhood I had. One parent who was lily white, almost pink, and the other parent who I referred to as the blue black, and very black. And somewhere within their connection, I was born this this brown child.
What did bring your mother? I'm interested now. You've intrigued me. What did bring her from the Torres Strait to Mackay?
Torres Strait people have a long history of, I guess, spirituality. And this dates back pre-missionaries. There was a strong cultural practice and way people behaved. And my mother fell pregnant when she was, I think, like 22 with my older sister. And this was frowned upon because it was out of wedlock. So my mum became like a handmaiden who would be passed around between families and look after other women. And her own child was removed from her and raised by her older sister. So one of her cousins by the name of Uncle Jack Cannell, his wife was having difficulty with her labour, and a request went back to the Torres Straits from Mackay for a handmaiden to come. And so my mum came to look after the family, and after she served her purpose in her role, he said to her, "You have a choice now. You can either go back to the Torres Straits or you can have another life here." And considering English at the time was my mum's third language, I think it was quite brave of her to say, "Look, I want to stay here and see what my life would be like on the mainland."
You mentioned that spirituality being a large part of Torres Strait Island culture. Mm. Your mum was a kind of seer, wasn't she? And what did that mean?
It's seer in our communities, you know, women who read the teacups and all of those sorts of things. I remember women coming into our house and wanting to find out what the identity of their children were going to be, and people had come in with dreams and she'd interpret dreams. Before I was born, I came to her in a dream that I was going to be a singer. And we have this ritual in our family, which I'm not too sure other islanders have, you know, because I've spoken with other community people and go, "Oh, no, that's a bit off that thing." And on the night of our child being born, we take the sweat from various places of our body, rub our children from head to toe. And
the newborn baby.
Newborn baby. And we say that this smell is the family you belong to. And being a collective society, there is a responsibility as us as an individual in that collective not to embarrass or bring a bad name to the family. So we go through all of that. So, you know, your first day in the world is like, "Well, you're going to do this in this life," and blah, 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 blah. And then we give spit. We open the child's mouth and we say, "In this life you're going to be..." And my mother's spit for me was to be a singer. With my own children, I've had dreams of them. My oldest son, I think I was 15 at the time when he was born, so as part of the ritual, I just wished him to be a strong, proud, noble man in this life. His sister, I had a dream that she was going to be a lawyer, so the spit that I gave to her at birth was to be a lawyer, and now she's working for a law firm in the city here. And it's not something we push them into. It's a dream of their future. My three-year-old, I had a dream that he was an architect. And from two or three, he would collect bits of wood and he'd say, "Dad, look at my helicopter here, look at my plane." So he's constantly building stuff. So these are traits of something that comes. Anyway.
My wife's a bit spooky like that too. When she was pregnant with our son, he introduced himself to her and said he was going to be an artist.
Okay. Cool.
So this does happen. So it's more common than we think. This Torres Strait Islander culture, it goes back and has this very ancient sort of practice. Mm. But it's also very Christian too, isn't it? Tell me how those two mix.
Well, my uncle, Jack Cannell, who I spoke about, he told me of this legend that's centred around Murray Island and this creature called Mallow. Now, in the Torres Straits, we have what we call zogols, or cults that we belong to, or totems, and one of the cults was Mallow. And Mallow, he said, came in the form of a squid. Around Murray Island, the sea's black with sardines, and they use what they call a werris to scoop up the sardines. And while she was scooping up the sardines, she caught this sugul, or squid, and she was getting ready to kill it, and the squid spoke to her and said, "If you don't kill me," he said, "I will make you young." And we all want to be young, so, yeah, why not? And as the days progressed, she started getting younger, and the squid asked her to promise not to reveal his identity to anyone. The husband could see she was getting younger. She confided in the husband, and then people in the village got suspicious, and they confronted this couple that was rapidly growing young about they thought they had puri puri, or black magic. And she presented the squid to them, and the squid said, "If you let me go, I will come back again in the form of light to look after you." And when he left them a set of laws to live by. So on Murray Island, there are eight clans, which are representative of the squid's arms. And 1st of July, 1871, the London Missionary Society came to Darnley Island in one of the Torres Strait's days of celebration is the 1st of July. When the missionaries came to the Torres Straits, they said, "We bring you the light of the world."
Oh.
And when they looked at Mallow's teachings and Christianity's teachings, they were one and the same. So that's why Torres Strait people, you either find us full-blown Christians or devout heathens who are party animals.
It's like a completely pagan Old Testament, isn't it? And then suddenly the New Testament arrives and there it is.
Exactly.
Were you drawn to religion as a little boy?
There were only two things I wanted to be, I guess, as a young child growing up in Mackay. One was to be a minister in the church or to be a musician. One had celibacy, so I went the other way.
But there's a stage or a pulpit and...
And that's what I grew up with. And I think it was Church of the World that... And they were very colourful. If you looked at it, it looked almost African. Caftans, stretch limousine would drive down from Cairns once a month to collect the church tidings. And I thought, this seems to be a good business to be in.
Now, you didn't grow up in the Torres Strait. You grew up in Mackay. Did you have any connection, though, with the island your mother was from?
Yes. Look, even now when we go back and we talk about our ghee or our roots, and my roots in the central regions of the Torres Straits on my grandmother's side, and on my grandfather's side, they're on a small little island called Ugar, or Stephen Island, which is in the furthest eastern region of the Torres Straits. Now, what's wonderful about going back into those communities, people will say, "Your ghee's here, your ancestry's here."
And do you believe that?
Oh, definitely. I mean, I haven't been to Scotland yet, but I'm sure when I go to Aberdeen, there is something within my genetic makeup that'll go, "Well, this feels like home to me." Not that I'll see 6'4" balding islanders walking around, but I'm sure there is something in me. I mean, Bligh, when he was sent adrift from the Bounty, he sailed through the Torres Straits. In one of his ship logs, he goes past what he called Warrior Reef, or Tudu, which was our stronghold of our ancestor by the name of Kebusu, Ate Kebusu, or Grandad Kebusu, and he gave chase. The only thing that saved Bligh that day was they had the wind and the tide with them. Because normally that region is reef, dry reef. So if he would have come at the wrong time, there would have been at least 100 headhunting cannibals would have had chicken that night.
So they call it chicken?
Yeah, chicken.
I have a picture in my head of life in the Torres Strait Islands, and it might be completely wrong, I don't know, but a kind of super abundant natural paradise with blue water, crystalline water, that might be occasionally be black with fish, as you say. Have I got the right picture there,
Katana? Look, there's always the wonderful and I guess the non-wonderful side of life in the islands. Most of my visits there, unfortunately, have been for sad occasions. Some of my work has been with different arts bodies doing work with children, which to me had been wonderful work. I just love not only the innocence, but the kids, everything is...
It is what it is.
It is what it is. And very honest about, you know, their interactions with each other. I couldn't live on a little island like that. If you imagine, you know, there's a population of, say, 300 or 400 people on a little island, and, you know, out of that 400 people, 300 are kids. There's not much to do on an island. Get cable. And everyone knows everyone's business. And I think that's good and it's bad. So, you know, I've enjoyed my excursions back home, but I've also loved the isolation in some sense of living in a big metropolis.
Katano, your dad, there's a more complex portrait in some ways. Describe your dad to me. You said he was a 10-pound Scot who came here. And once he'd arrived in Mackay, what do you recall of him?
My mother and father seemed, I mean, they talk about odd couples, but this is an odd couple. My mother being, you know, semi-illiterate, the great-granddaughter of a war chieftain, so she was a princess, one for a better word. And you had this 10-pound Scotsman who came out to Australia looking for, you know, fun and adventure or whatever. And I said to my mum, what did you see in him? She said, he was the saddest man I ever saw in the whole of my life. I thought, great, that's a great way to start a relationship. My father, in Torres Strait culture, Torres Strait men will hold each other's hands, will put our arms around each other. We'll probably show more affection to each other as men than as man and woman, you know. My father would get news of family members who died, would show no emotion. I'd sit with my uncles and they would cry seeing their son playing football on the weekend. So I was constantly bombarded by this man who was unemotional. My only conversations would centre around him sending me to the fridge as a young guy to get him a beer. I think I had my first drink when I was like 6 or 7. And by the third or fourth beer that he'd request, I'd be drunk, passed out in the hallway. Because as a kid, you open the bottle and...
and have a taste on the way back.
And have a taste on the way back. So, you know, my father would get these half-filled bottles. And I was probably a full-blown alcoholic by the age of 12. And, you know, I stopped drinking, oh, God, when I was like 18 or 19. So apart from those things, my father's philosophy was if a man didn't have a job, then he had no sense of value in life. And I subscribed to that for many years. But I figured if a person didn't feel whole and centered in yourself, it doesn't matter what you do in your life, it's never going to be pleasing or satisfying for you. I think my dad actually helped me with my songwriting in that he was a highly intelligent man. Like, he would sit and read the paper, you know, front to back, back to front. You could strike a conversation about anything, you know, with my dad. But, the other sad thing too is the time when my parents were together. You know, Mackay was a racist, redneck little town at that stage. And my father would always walk 4 or 5 metres in front of us. And my mother would drag these two brown-haired kids with these huge afros behind, you know.
So your father would walk 4 or 5 steps ahead of the rest of the family?
Yeah.
Why?
I guess it was to do with the shame. And, you know, my father was the only white man I saw in my family until, oh, I don't know, 10, maybe 14, 15 years old. So in a sense, my mother was the first person outside of our family to marry outside of Torres Strait culture.
You said that your mum said that when she saw your father, he was the saddest man she'd ever seen. Why do you think she was drawn to melancholy?
Oh, look, I don't know. Maybe there's a maternal thing that, because that was her job, was to look after women who gave birth. She didn't have her child. She had this option of staying in Mackay, and I guess she saw someone who she could take care of and not have to hand back. If you imagine you're a handmaiden, you look after everyone's children, there comes a time when you have to hand those children back and then you go to the next family and develop those relationships again.
How well did they connect? How successful was their relationship?
Oh, look, you know, as a a youth worker who works with disadvantaged families, I think they struggled, you know, incredibly so. And there must have been loving components of that union. But, you know, realistically, I think my mum was illiterate. It was at a stage when women had no other income. I think my father loved to drink. We lived in a street where one side of the street was white and the other side was black. And in the white families, there was German, Dutch, Welsh, English, Yugoslavian, and another one. On this side, you had Torres Strait, South Sea Islanders, Aborigines. And
what side of the street were you on?
We're on the black side.
Right.
With this crazy Scotsman. So we were constantly judged, I guess, at school, in the street, in town, in the street we lived in. They were together 22 years. So I think sometimes you deal with the devil you know. And, you know, the only other option for my mum was to go back into the Torres Straits and then continue her life again as a handmaiden. So
she was trapped a little bit, either way.
Yeah, I feel definitely so. Mm.
Although your dad was kind of a dour Scotsman in that sense, believing in hard work, hard drinking, not unemotional, that sort of thing,
yes.
There was something that could make him get a little bit undone, which was his Andy Stewart records. What would he do when he was playing Andy Stewart?
Look, my father had this practice. Every Friday night he would come home, strip off his clothes, and he'd be in his Bond underwear and Bond shirt. And then we would endure, and I use endure, Andy Stewart for the next 3 or 4 hours until he passed out. My younger brother and myself would collect him, drag him into the room, and it's like, okay, it's television time now.
So your father would disrobe, put on Andy Stewart, and then drink himself into a stupor as he sang along, essentially.
And that was every Friday night, you know. And I always thought it was a practice in Western society that all men came home and did that on a Friday night. But I think that's where my father's defences was down, and we'd see a more humorous side in him. Like, my dad was like a real sarcastic bee, and very cutting in his wit. And he would say stuff and people would go, is he having a go at me? You know, and we'd see that time and time and time and time again. And so on the Friday night, the defence is down, literally. I remember one night in particular, my dad ended up with some infection or something in his ear that he actually, it was his left ear. And he ended up having maggots growing in it, you know, and it was that bad. And my younger brother would play these tricks on him. You know, he'd be in the kitchen going, Dad, it's... And my dad would be clobbering his left ear going, what? And my brother would be going, Dad, blah, 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 blah. And my mother would scream out, Jock! Because my dad's name was Jonathan. It's time for tea. And I can't repeat the words that my father would say, but it'd be like bedlam for the next 15 minutes while my father's trying to strangle my little brother's neck.
A lot of kids who are having a difficult time at home have a hideaway place. Did you have a hideaway place?
The toilet. And this was the old thunder box, you know, the old... And when you were down the back, you were left alone, you know, except for your mother screaming out to get you to go to the shop or something. One of the funniest things was is that my younger brother and myself, when one of us would go into the old outhouse, you know, you have the open roof for the good air to come in and the bad air to go out. And we would throw sawdust through the openings and then we'd stick a hose and hose who's ever in the toilet. So this was an ongoing battle. Anyway, I remember being at the front one time kicking a ball and next thing I heard my younger brother sing out, Mom, if you want me, I'll be in the toilet. So anyway, I ran around the front. And the street I lived in was called Palm Street, so there was just palms everywhere. And I found the hairiest and meanest and largest-looking coconut I could find. And I sprinted down the side of the house, aiming for the dunny door. I leaned back, full speed. I threw it. Next thing, bang! And the toilet door nearly shattered from the force of this coconut. Next thing, the door swings open. And here's my mum trying to pull up her bloomers, screaming, you know, which little so-and-so did that? And my younger brother comes out and he looks at me and waves his finger. I guess the other retreat for me was we lived on the Pioneer River and I spent copious amounts of time walking up and down that river, dreaming of faraway places, I guess. And I guess it's when songwriting became my escape. I mean, I was illiterate or semi-illiterate until about the age of 16, but through, I guess, word plays with my father, with watching television. You know, I still remember going down to Mrs. Seavers's place and go, Auntie Irene, can we come and watch television? And she'd say, yes, from 4:30 to 5 o'clock you can watch TV and then you have to go home for tea, you know. And this medium, you know, words again. So I guess to me, the riverbank became my place of escape.
How come you said you didn't learn to read and write until you were 16? Why was that? Why? How were you left behind like that?
Well, I think, you know, I look at my three-year-old now and he's just bombarded by, you know, television, computers,
text,
blah, 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 all this. As a kid growing up in Mackay, I used to have a bad stutter. And the only time you can tell that I'm stutter is when I'm tired, you know, and my family look at me and said, time to go to bed because I'll go, and I used to stutter something chronic when I was a kid. So if you can imagine standing up in class, you know, grade one or two, trying to talk and people laughing at you all, sit down and the teachers, you know, after a while, no, let's not go to this kid, you know, for whatever reasons, he's going to embarrass himself or whatever. So, and I think if you have two children at home and one's constantly getting your attention, all your time and effort are going to be on that student. And the kids who don't talk or remain quiet, like the song I wrote, Silent Sun, stand in the corner, don't say anything, and just look and observe. What that taught me was to read life. I think of myself sometimes as Foghorn Leghorn. You know, hey boy, do you think I like talking just to hear myself roar?
Nice boy, but about as sharp as a bowling ball.
Yes. And I find myself roaring now, and no one's hearing me. And whereas before, I would be the one listening and observing. So I think it's easy to get left behind in those sorts of environments. And, you know, it wasn't until grade 10 when I left school, I soon discovered that I was going nowhere.
Some men in your family used to make money from collecting trochus shells off the Great Barrier Reef. First of all, tell me what they are and how you find them.
Well, I went out a couple of times with one of my uncles, and trochus shells are a cone-looking shell. They're sort of
like a sea snail, that kind of thing.
Yeah, I'm not too sure what you call it, but you know, buttons, cosmetic stuff are made from these shells. I was looking for some work, and my uncle offered for me to go out in the boat with him. And ideally, you would like to collect trochus shells when it's low tide, and you just walk along the reef, and you fill up your bucket, and you know, I think I was getting like $20 a bucket or something like that, you know, collecting. When we got there, it was high tide. I remember the morning, as soon as light comes out on the reef, it's time to go and collect. So it could be like 4:30, 5 o'clock in the morning. You're out on the reef. I'm here in this dinghy with my uncle. He's closing his eyes and he's going through a prayer ritual to keep us safe in the water. And this grey-tipped reef shark goes under the boat. Not lengthwise, breathwise. I can see its tail on one side and its head on the other. And it just swims nonchalant past us. I'm sitting there. My uncle opens his eyes and goes, okay, boy, time to get in the water. I can't repeat what I was thinking, but, you know. And he literally jumped out of the boat and rocked me out of the boat. You know, the men...
He just pushed you out of the boat, straight into the water. Right.
Get in the water, you know.
Right.
And men would dive and they would collect, you know, anywhere between 6 to 18 shells. I would dive and I would collect 2 or 3 shells. So it wasn't a very profitable adventure for me. And then, you know, we'd be back and we'd have breakfast at 8 o'clock, be back in the water again at 9, 1 o'clock back on the boat, lunch, 1 to 3, sleep, 3 to 4, 5, 6 in the water, come have something to eat. From 9 to 11, 1 o'clock in the morning, we'd be cleaning, boiling shell. And that was my life for about 3 weeks, 6 days a week out on the
18-hour days, most of it underwater.
Yeah, in the water. and you shriveled and you and you smell of troika shell.
Listening to Conversations with Richard Feidler on air, online, and on digital radio. You can subscribe totally free to Conversations podcast. Details on the website abc.net.au/conversations.
Today you're hearing the story of Gaetano Ban. Gaetano is a singer-songwriter. His mum's family were Torres Strait Islanders, and his dad was a Scottish migrant. And Gaetano grew up being tugged a bit between these two cultures in Mackay in North Queensland. Gaetano practices something called music therapy. He does this with teenagers who've arrived in Australia from war-torn countries, who are having some difficulty reconciling their past with their present. And he does this with homeless kids and also with people with drug and alcohol dependency problems. Gaetano, I said singer-songwriter there, but for a while you went to study dance. How did that happen? How did you get distracted into dance for a while?
Oh, look, going back to the school, I realised that I was going nowhere very quickly. And I went and seen my guidance officer, Val Wright. You know, I guess there are significant people in your lives along the way. Val Wright will be that for me. And she said, "What do you want to do?" I said, "I want to learn to play guitar," because I remember watching my uncle Ernest Owang, who was an amazing guitarist, you know, the Shadows and Ventures sort of stuff, and he'd play the guitar with his teeth and all of that.
Is there a good culture of guitar playing? Like, I don't know, it seemed like on NAIDOC Week I met about three brilliant Torres Strait Island guitarists, and you were one of them.
No, Richard, there's only four of us.
That's it, I just met all of them on the one day. Okay.
Oh, look, music is part of us. It's not a recreational thing. It's day-to-day existence stuff. I would hear my mother singing hymns, looking at Saturday's racing form, and then the next week seeing her sing the hymn in church or at a funeral service. And so music is an integral part of our makeup.
So you wanted to play guitar. Where did they send you?
When Val was going through, you know, the different institutes that are available for training Indigenous young people, she came across the Aboriginal and the Dance Theatre. And I said, "Look, I'm not too keen to become a dancer," but she said, "Well, you know, dance and music go together." She lied to me, the mongrel. I found myself straight off the plane and in tights and supports, leg warmers and ballet shoes.
Well, you don't exactly have a dancer's physique. You don't exactly have the sylph-like body that's required for, neither do I for that matter.
Oh, no. look, Richard, I was about a third of my size back then, you know. So I became a dancer, you know, with the Aboriginal and the Dance Theatre. I mean, I was always, you asked, how could you be overlooked at school in regards to, you know, academic stuff? I mean, I was very good at athletics. I was going to come and try out for the Commonwealth Games. And my PE teacher sort of had that all geared up. We had this influx of American teachers, and his name was Flip Simons. So, Flip, if you're out there, hi. But I was trying to figure out, was it his ambition or was it my ambition? You know, it came to that. And after playing copious amounts of sports, I worked on the milk run. That was my first job when I was a kid. I probably in a week would be running somewhere to 60 to 80 kilometres a week, from football to milk runs. So I was quite a fit young guy. So moving into dance, and I love dance. I mean, I remember being 15-year-old and going along to these grown-up dances at the Metropolitan Hotel, and Saturday Night Fever was all a rage at the time, and I could do splits, and I actually won a weekend for two away with this Fiona Douglas. So, hi, Fiona, if you're out there, to Sydney. And I was like 15 at the time. She was 19. And we were all geared up for this wonderful weekend away until she asked me how old I was. And I was like, "Oh, I'm 15. She said, "You're sleeping on that bed." You know, so that was that. So as a singer-songwriter and someone who plays music with a history of dance, you look at music a different way. It's not, I'm singing a song now. You can see people, how they move to it, you know. I remember part of my playing was in restaurants, and you'd see people sitting there eating. But where you would look is under the table, and you would see people moving their legs or tapping a sway. And I thought, as long as their legs sway, I would be having a job in this restaurant. And the restaurant owner would come up and say, oh, everybody thinks you're wonderful and, you know, we'll have you back next week and blah, 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 being oblivious to what I was looking at. And I was looking at people's legs moving. And I knew as long as their legs moved, I could afford to feed my family the next week.
So much of what you've said so far suggests that a bit of shame was put on you all the time as a kid. Your father would walk ahead of the rest of his Torres Strait Islander family. And you had a stutter, as you say. And when did you learn to get past that and realise there was no need to be ashamed? In fact, every reason not to be ashamed.
Look, in Mackay, where we lived in Cremon, there are two bridges. One comes from Baker's Creek, one comes from the Forgansmith Bridge. And there's sort of this little peninsula or this little island sort of community where a lot of white, poor families and black families lived. My father would go to town, drink himself into oblivion, and then he would make the walk across the bridge. He would then have to negotiate over four lanes of traffic. He would have to go through this field of guinea grass, which probably was the size of two, maybe three football fields together. The last bit of the football field, as kids, we used to build these huge tunnels. So he'd have to negotiate himself through the guinea grass, through these collapsed tunnels. Then he would have to come to the train crossing, which was sugarcane. He'd have to make his way over the train tracks. And then the last hurdle was a sewage pipe, which he'd have to either slide himself under or slide himself over. And then he would negotiate the fence to get in our yard. So my mum could time him perfectly. So while she's listening to the horses, she'd be looking out the window and she'd say, "Here he comes!" And we would stand there on the pipe and watch our father. As soon as he'd disappear in the guinea grass, we'd know he'd be down one of the bunkers. So I'd get my younger brother and we'd go. And sometimes one of us would have to get down for him to stand up on top of us. My father then would proceed to take his clothes off. And my father had this, my brother's going to say, "Why did you say this?" My father had this peculiar habit. If he had underwear on and no Bond singlet, he would feel naked. So we'd have to run around looking for a singlet for him to cover himself.
Right.
If my father had a singlet and no underwear, he felt clothed. So during the course of Saturday afternoons, my father in his various get-ups would go out and do work in our front yard.
No pants.
No pants. No. Just a singlet and
out, free and easy, the way God made him.
Yes. Our house being the top of the street, everyone had to drive by.
But that's embarrassment. That's embarrassment for you, profound
look,
embarrassment.
My mother would be screaming, "Get your father's trousers on!" You know.
But it doesn't come to that larger issue of shame I was talking about, though. Well, when did you become politicised, or did you just, was it a more of a personal revelation that you needn't feel ashamed of yourself for being who you are?
Well, we lost all sense of embarrassment, I guess, from the antics of my father. When we went to Sydney, we were bombarded with Indigenous consciousness. We had people who spoke with us who were involved in the Tent Embassy, who were at the forefront of Indigenous promoting the plight. You know, one of the most amazing women I met in my life was a woman called Shirley Smith, and I would recommend people go out there and read her life story. I was working on a student newspaper called AIM, which was the Aboriginal Islander Message, and Bobby Sykes, I don't know if you're familiar with Bobby Sykes, she was the editor of it. We had this exclusive on story of Mum Shirl, her biography had just come out, and people like Time, international papers were trying to get this. And she said, "No, I want this little Indigenous community paper to come out and interview me." When I sat and listened to this woman and her stories, I literally sat there and cried the whole time. And I felt so ashamed of, because I grew up with this, "I'm poor, I'm black, I'm this, I'm that, I'm that." And within a week of living with her, she changed my...
In what way? How did she change it?
One of the guys that she was looking after in this refectory, he was murdered for $6. She was organising his funeral. She asked me to come to the funeral service, which I thought was a bit bizarre because I didn't know this guy. I rocked up that morning, 3 days later, to the service. I could see all these derelict people with rope trousers, you know, who stank and all those sorts of things, you know, piling into the church. Next thing, the car pulled up, and there were three, maybe four stretched limousines. And what I would call uptown blacks. Got out of the car, you know, three-piece suits, the watch on the chain. And it was just a real dichotomy between these two groups. Went into the church. I was waiting outside for Mum Shirl. She hadn't arrived yet. So I went into the church and I sat at the back of these street people. And next thing, the altar boys came out with the incense and the church proceedings start. She came in. I can't repeat what she said. Mum Shirl's known for her colourful language, and she was screaming at the top of her voice that this service would not proceed until everybody intermingled. She said, "This man's dead and you're worried about your status, you know." When we got out of the church, the limousines pulled up and she looked at these street people and said, "Have people got lifts?" And they said, "No." She said, "Gaetano, open the limousines, put these people in the car." And you could see the faces of these, you know, the drivers. And she said, "Do you have a problem?" And they're going, "No." And next thing, windows are down and the mini bars are open, and, you know. And she just grabbed me and she said, "Gaetano," she said, "most of us, all of us, would walk over one of these people if they were laying in the street. We'd step over them to get on with our busy day." She said, "I hope you never are like these other people." And like I said, I was 16, 17 at the time. I remember a few years ago in an agency I was working at, and I had a pretty good govy job, and I had, you know, clothes and VCRs and blah, blah, blah. And I remember going to work, I think it was my second or third week there, and I remembered that image of the church. I just collected my belongings, put them in my car, drove into the compound in this community agency I worked with, and I said, "Take whatever you like. These material things really don't bring us any joy."
So you went to dance school to learn music, and you didn't get the music, but you got the dance and you got everything else in it, and it changed. What about the music? When did you finally become?
Went to the Centre of Aboriginal Studies and Music in Adelaide. The thing about the school, as soon as you walked in, here's a guitar, this is an F chord, this 12-bar progression is called the blues, and you start playing. And then all of a sudden, the melodies I was creating, and you as a creative person, if you strip a song down to its basics, it's a rhythm, it's a melody. So I had rhythm and melody wasn't a problem. It was the accompanying chords. And all of a sudden, this explosion of music happened.
All right, so you had the songs in your head already, and you had the guitar finally just gave you a vessel to hold them all in.
Yeah.
How did you get the idea to become a music therapist?
I was working at the Mater Hospital. They have this service for adolescents, and they asked me if I'd like to come and do music with the young people. And I said, "Look, after working with disadvantaged youth," I said, "I just don't want to go there and I want to do nice stuff." I said, "I want to think of myself as an egg cracker." And they said, "Egg cracker?" I said, "Yeah. If you're an adolescent, you're in a drug rehab centre, there's something not right about this picture." And I said, "I want to use music as a way for them to write songs and explore this." In one of those sessions, we were writing songs about who are the people in your family you would buy gifts for as support systems, you know? This Indian young woman stood up, screamed like a banshee, ran out of the room, and staff came running in like, "What did you say and do to her?" I said, "Oh, nothing." She disappeared for an hour. And I was thinking, what didn't I see there? What didn't I pick up on? That was like the Wednesday. On the Sunday, there was an article about music therapy by Jane Edwards, another significant person in my life, and they were holding auditions for music therapists. I went along to one of the auditions. She asked me to play some of my songs, and she sat there and she cried during the audition, which I thought, oh, this isn't anything new. People think my songs must be so bad that they just sit and cry. 2 hours later, she rang me while I was at a wake hall doing a prison visit with a young person. She said, "I'm going to put a strong recommendation for you to be in the course, but it's going to be very hard for you. Having failed school, you know, literacy issues, not being able to read music, blah, 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 but you have something that you can offer this profession." And I thought, yeah, okay. 3 months when I entered the course and I got hit with my first series of essays, I didn't know how to type, you know. And then I would find myself typing at 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning, trying to get myself to sleep so I can get up and feed my daughter and send her to school the next day as a single parent sharing those parenting duties with her mum. I thought, what the hell am I doing this for? And I remember the course convener pulling me in, and she said, "You meet none of our criteria, you're struggling, you know." But she said, "Jane must have seen something in you for you to still be doing this." And I guess it wasn't until the practical application, because of years of songwriting in the community, that they could see what I could do. Once I left that course, they'd found every loophole in it and closed it quickly. And I graduated 3 years after that as a music therapist.
And the work you do now, how do you use music as therapy, and who are the people you're working with?
When I was working at Milperra, I think I worked there for about 5 years, and I had to work with these boys who had anger management issues and who were disrespecting some of the female teachers and that. And then you'd talk with them, and they were boy soldiers. And they'd been soldiers since the age of 6 to 8 or whatever, here in this country now at the age of 14 to 19, and told you had to read or write or be working.
They were boy soldiers. From where?
Burma, from the Karen people, from Sudan, from Burundi, Congo, and in amongst that, refugees.
And they'd arrived in Australia into
school,
into school in pleasant, sunny Australia.
Yeah.
It must have done their head in a little bit.
And it was a relief for them in some ways. You don't hit us if we don't play up. You know, no, we send you down to see this balding islander who's going to do music with you. Cool, all right.
And once they told you that they were boy soldiers, what happened then?
To engage with anyone, you have to know what their story is. And I remember sitting at the piano one day doing some improvisation with this young Burundian boy. If you looked at him, he looked like he was 8, but I think he was 13 or 14 at the time. The biggest fear, I guess, or the thing with some of these children that creates fear in them is silence.
Why?
Well, if you can imagine you're escaping, the militia is coming to kill you, you go and hide in the bush and you need to keep quiet. Because any bit of noise will give away your position. And if you gave away your position, you'd be slaughtered. And he said one afternoon the militia came into the village. His father picked him up because he was a young boy, held him over his shoulder, and they were running away. And he could see his two sisters following behind. The militia caught them and hacked them to death with machetes. And when we were playing this piece of music, I asked him what had made him sad, and he said, he asked me first, "What made you sad?" And I said, "When I think of my mother, there are a lot of things I wanted to do and say to her, but I didn't know at the time, you know." And I said, "What made you sad?" And he said, "When I think of my sisters." And then he told me that story, and I just sat and I howled after he left and just thought, what the hell, how can people do this, you know, senseless killings or hacking of people's hands. Or it was after that session, I just thought, I need some time out to really rethink what my priorities are and the things that I do in life and how I relate to people.
Finally, Gaetano, your father, you went and saw him as he was dying. Just tell me that story of what happened when you went to see your father. I'm sure all this work has brought up all these kind of feelings of what's unresolved with your father. What happened when you saw him in hospital?
Each Christmas, I would get messages from my parents wherever I was in Australia that one of them was dying or sick. Come home! I was going, oh, here we go again. And, you know, my personal life at that time, there was a relationship that ended. My child, who I'd raised as you know, a Mr. Mum, had been taken away. And my life was just in a spiral of going nowhere. And my mother called me. I went home, and my father, from the years of drinking, had a build-up of sugar in one of his arteries, which had to be removed, and apparently it was the size of a tennis ball. I, to this day, believe that he caught golden stuff while he was being operated, and this led to complications and his lungs collapsing. I mean, he was a heavy smoker, and he was all these things, but, you know. And I remember it was probably 3 or 4 days before he died. And this Catholic priest came into the room, and my mother was on one side holding his hand, and I was the son standing looking at the father. And the Catholic priest asked my dad if he had any family in Mackay. And it was silent. And then he asked him again, "Mr. Gordon, do you have family here in Mackay?" And my mum looked at me, and we looked in. And then he said again, I said, "Hold it, Father. I can't repeat exactly what I said, but the word rhymed with truck." I said, "This is his trucking wife. I'm his trucking son. We're his trucking family." And with that, the Catholic priest looked at me and he said, "I can see you're all busy and I'll come back later." I said, "Yeah, you do that." And I was 22 at that time. And I looked at my father and I could see my mother crying, walking out with the priest or the minister, whatever he was. And I looked at my dad and I said, "Why?" You know, after everything that we've been through, my thinking, it was like, "Why?" And my dad looked at me and he just put his head down. And that was the last thing I said to my dad. I think it was a couple of days later that Helen, one of the nurses, told me that because he collapsed, he was on a ventilating machine. And she said, "If you want to speak with your father, we're going to inject the next amount of drugs into him and blah, blah, blah. And if you want to say anything to him, now's the chance." And I held my dad in my arms and I said, "I don't know what it's like to die. There are so many things I wish we would have said to each other. You know, just a simple, I love you and I'm proud of who you are." And I said, "But I'll be with you until you go." And I think it was the next morning, all the machines started counting down and I held him and he died in my arms.
Was that in your mind when you wrote the song Silent Son?
Yeah. I guess to me the song was about, I could see this man drinking his life away, but I couldn't connect with him. I didn't know what to say. And maybe sometimes in those settings, given the time, place, there is nothing to say. And at the end of the day, I guess all you can do with each other is hold each other until it's time to go.
Tana, we're going to go out with you performing that song, Silent Son. It's a very moving and powerful song. I've really loved having you in conversation today. It's been a story like no other. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Richard.
Singer-songwriter Gaetano Ban.
We did not talk like father and son. I dreaded your hand and you feared my love. And I watched you drink your life away. But I still write here, your silent son. Yes, I still write here. I still write here, your silent son. Yes, I still write here. I was told to listen, not speak. It was not words I sought, but your love I seeked. To be seen and not heard, to do as I'm told. But I still write here, your silent son. Yes, I still write here. I still write here, your silent son. Yes, I still write here. Why should it matter to me? You have now long gone. Oh, what is this pain that keeps on lingering on? Na 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 na. I watched your hand on my mother's face. I swallowed her tears, I held your rage deep in my soul. Torn and confused, but I still right here, your silent son. Yes, I still right here. I still right here, your silent son. Yes, I still right here. Why should it matter to me? You have now long gone. But what is this pain that keeps on lingering on? Mm-hmm. On and 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 on. Son, leave my my side. I felt his tears, though he did not cry. And I said, my God, what have I done? And I cried the tears for my silent son. And I cried the tears. I cried the tears for my silent son. And I cried the tears.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations with Richard Feidler. For more information and interviews, visit abc.net.au/conversations.